Heavenly Father, we just thank you for the opportunity to come and to learn how to be better witnesses and to study a little bit about your word. We just pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm supposed to be talking about witnessing to postmoderns, and as I thought about it, I decided that it would be better to talk about witnessing to people in a postmodern world, because we have more than just people that accept postmodernism. We still have those that are under rationalism or modernism and even some pre-moderns. And our society has changed. There's a plethora of new religions and old religions and religions coming from other parts of the world, or religions that are developing here in the United States. And we can no longer assume that when we witness to a person, they're going to understand the basic concepts of the gospel, or even that they're going to be familiar with the Bible. I'm reminded of an old joke of a lawyer. We don't have any attorneys here, do we? Okay, I can tell this joke. There was this lawyer who came into his law office on Monday, and he told his partner, "I've been asked to teach a Sunday school class at my church." Well, his partner was just aghast. He said, "You don't know anything about the Bible. You don't know anything about God or about religion. Why, your church has got to be absolutely crazy to ask you to teach a class." And the attorney was very offended. He said, "I'll have you know, I know a lot about the Bible. I know a lot about religion." And his partner still didn't believe him. So his partner said, "Okay, if you know so much about the Bible, what's the Lord's Prayer?" And the attorney thought about it for a moment, and he said, "Oh, that's easy. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep." And his partner just got a shocked look on his face. He said, "Man, I didn't know you knew so much about the Bible." Now, hopefully you know that's not the Lord's Prayer. I told that in one group, and I had to explain that to them. But there's a great amount of biblical ignorance in our society today. And that story is just indicative of it. Even in the so-called Bible Belt, we can't assume that people are going to be familiar with the Bible, or even that they're going to assume the existence of God. And we still, in the postmodern world, have atheism and agnosticism with us. And I like witnessing to atheists because I did my doctoral dissertation basically in that area of apologetics. And I remember I was sitting on an airplane in Washington, D.C. We were getting ready to fly out, and there was a, lost this name tag for the 50th time today. I'm just going to put it right here. We were getting ready to head out, and the guy that was sitting next to me turned to me and said, "Hi, I have a Ph.D. in genetic engineering. I work for the Department of Agriculture. What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a minister." And he said, "Well, I'm an atheist." And I said, "Well, that's nice. Are you aware of the fact that a lot of Christian theologians believe that atheism is illogical and irrational?" "Oh, I'm not illogical. I have a Ph.D. in genetic engineering." And I said, "Well, I didn't say you were ignorant. I just simply said that a lot of philosophers consider atheism to be self-contradictory and therefore illogical because it contradicts itself." "Well, I have a Ph.D. I wouldn't do something like that." "What do you mean it's self-contradictory?" And so I explained what he meant. And I started out and I said, "Well, now, when you say you're an atheist, do you mean that you know that there's no God anywhere?" "That's right. There's no God anywhere. I know that. I have a Ph.D. in genetic engineering." "Well, that is the atheistic position. However, you know, there's the agnostic position, which simply says, I don't know if there's a God or not. You know, that's the agnostic position." "No, I'm an atheist." I said, "Well, that's right. You have affirmed the atheistic position that you know that there is no God." Now, the reason why theologians believe that that is a self-contradictory position is because it affirms what philosophers call a universal negative. And he kind of gave me a blank look, and he said, "A universal negative?" And I said, "Well, a universal negative is when you say that something does not exist anywhere, period. Universally, it does not exist." And he said, "That's right. There is no God, period, anywhere." And I said, "Well, that's a universal negative." Now, the problem with affirming a universal negative is that the only way you can affirm a universal negative with any degree of confidence is if you have what's known as all knowledge. Now, the interesting thing is that One of the attributes of God that theologians have come to the conclusion that only God has, some even call it his incommunicable attributes that can belong only to God and no one else, is the attribute of omniscience or all knowledge. So by definition, the only being who has all knowledge is God. So therefore, the only one who can affirm atheism, the fact that there is no God, is God. So therefore, atheism is self-contradictory and therefore irrational. Well, he gave me a blank stare. And, he was quiet for a whole hour. And, finally sunk into him. Well, now, I was talking with a PhD student at LSU one time who was actually majoring in philosophy. We were in this course together. I was working on my doctorate and had to get some German out of the way. And LSU had this course for graduate students on German so they could get it out of the way. So I was actually taking this course over at the State University and had a bunch of graduate students in there with me. And she said, "I'm an atheist." And I said, well, a lot of people believe that's irrational. So, well, I'm a philosophy major. I'm not irrational. And I said, when you say that there is no God, you mean that everywhere? She said, "That's right. There is no God, period." I said, "Well, that's what's known as a universal negative." Now, let's put it this way, working on her doctorate in philosophy, she knew what a universal negative was. And when I pointed out to the fact that she had made a universal negative, she instinctively realized from her studies in philosophy that no one can make a universal negative. And the wheel started turning in her head, and instantly she turned to me and she said, "You're right, I'm an agnostic." Well, so then I asked, "Well, now, are you a sincere agnostic or are you an insincere agnostic? What's the difference?" Well, a sincere agnostic is simply somebody who doesn't know whether there's a God or not. They really are open to the possibility of there being a God. Now, an insincere agnostic is simply someone who uses agnosticism as an excuse to not have to deal with the question. So, "Well, I'm sincere." I said, "Well, if you're sincere, then you wouldn't mind if I shared with you why I believe in God and have placed my faith in Jesus Christ." And I won't go into my testimony like I did with her, but, these are some approaches that we can use in, dealing with people that may be atheistic or agnostic that we may encounter in our modern world. Now, one of the things about when you're dealing with an agnostic and you ask them, "Are you a sincere agnostic? Are you insincere?" The worst thing you can call somebody in our postmodern world is insincere. I mean, that's about the worst thing you can call somebody. Nobody wants to be known as being insincere. And if they say, "I'm sincere," then you wouldn't mind if I shared with you why I do believe in God and have placed my faith in Jesus Christ. Now, in addition to atheism and agnosticism, we have some people who do believe that God exists, but they don't accept the Christian understanding of God. We have a lot of non-Western concepts of God. Many of them actually are coming from Eastern religions. People have borrowed some concepts and maybe adapted them to the American or European society, kind of like Americanized Hinduism. And there are all kinds of concepts that people have about God that are not really compatible with the traditional Christian understanding of God. I remember a few years ago I was at a Hindu temple in Tennessee, and we were taking a tour of the temple, and one of the public relations people was taking us on this tour, and she realized we were Christians. And I asked her, "Is it true that the Hindu understanding of God is that God is impersonal?" And she said, "Oh, yes, we do not believe in a personal God. We believe that God is impersonal." And this is part of their whole understanding of pantheism. Everything is God. The carpet is God, the chair is God, you're God, I'm God. When everything is God, God is no longer a personal being. God becomes impersonal. Now, that's radically different from the concept of God that we as Christians hold. And now, there are some implications of that belief system that a lot of the people that hold it aren't aware of. Now, if God is impersonal, then that means that, at least if I understand anything, that the impersonal must somehow be closer to God than the personal. Logically, I mean, if God is impersonal, then to get the closer you get to God, the more impersonal you get. Now, of course, this is coming from a kind of Hinduistic concept where God is impersonal. Now, not all Eastern religions necessarily teach that God is impersonal, but many of them do. And this particular lady did. And she thought about it for a moment, and she said, well, yes, that's right. The impersonal must be higher or closer to God than the personal is. So then I asked her the next question. Well, if the impersonal is closer to God or at a higher level than the personal, do you treat the personal as having less value than you do the personal? For example, see the rock over here? That's an impersonal object. Do you treat that rock as having more value than, say, your child? Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. Well, the problem is that instinctively or intuitively, human beings realize that personal objects or personal beings have more value than the impersonal. I mean, we know that instinctively. People instinctively treat their children, who are personal beings, as having more value than the impersonal. No one would treat a garbage can as having more value than, say, a baby that was lying in the garbage can. And when we read about in the news or on the TV about someone has taken a baby and put it in a dumpster, you know, there's a moral outrage that most people feel when we hear about something like that. And the problem with someone who says that God is impersonal is that we don't act consistently, or it's impossible to act consistently as if that's really true. It's an easy thing to affirm that God is impersonal, but it's something totally different to act and to live consistently with that belief system. Because all of us tend to treat personal beings as having more value or more worth or at a higher level than, say, the impersonal. And that's just built into us. I would argue that it's been hardwired into us by God when He created us. And that's true of everyone, even someone who affirms that God is impersonal. And it's an opportunity for us to witness as Christians. And I pointed out to the lady when she said, oh no, I would never, you know, treat that rock as having more value than, say, my child. I said, well, isn't it interesting that you act as if what the Bible says is true? You know, the Bible teaches that God is a personal being. You know, the Bible gives God a name, actually gives Him several names. The Bible indicates that God can act, God thinks, God can intervene in human affairs. We can have a personal relationship with God through faith. We can worship God. The Bible presents God as being a personal being, as being a personal God. And we as human beings made in the image of God are also personal beings. And because we're made in the image of God, we have more worth than that which is not made in the image of God, such as an impersonal object. And I pointed out to her, isn't it interesting that you act and live as if the Bible were true? And this is an opening for sharing the gospel with these people. I'm running through a lot of these things real quick, so if you have any questions, why don't you write them down, and then when I finish, I'll try to leave time for questioning. Now, if everything is God, there's also a corollary of that. I must be God, and you must be God. Have you ever tried to witness to someone who thought they were God? One of the things that I do is I will, at least once a year, sometimes more, I'll rent a booth at a New Age meeting. You know, the New Agers believe that all religions are true, so they have a hard time keeping Christians out if they want to be consistent with their belief system. And I'll, you know, rent a booth, and I've done this for about 10 years, and they've got to where they know me now. Actually, one year, our booth got voted the most popular booth at the New Age Fair because we were the only ones that were giving anything out for free. And so I'll go to these meetings, and a friend was helping me one time by the name of David. You know, and we were, you know, we had a little table, kind of like that table right there, and we had New Testaments and tracts, and we were giving them out to people as they would come by, and we would talk to people, and I was having a busy enough time just giving out stuff behind the table. Well, you know, David's one of these people. I mean, he's one of these guys that put me to shame when it comes to witnessing. I mean, he just witnesses at a drop of the hat. He's always witnessing to people. I feel inferior every time I get around him and see him witnessing to someone. Well, David wasn't satisfied just sitting behind the table. David wanted to go out and actually talk to the New Agers at their tables. And I said, well, that's fine, David, go ahead. Well, he came back 30 minutes later, and he was as white as a sheet. I said, David, what's wrong? He said, I was witnessing to this guy. And if any of you had evangelism explosion training, EE, well, one of the questions in EE is, suppose you were standing before God, and God asked you, why should I let you into my heaven? What would you say? Well, David asked this question to one of these New Agers. And the New Ager thought about it for a moment and said, I'll have you know that I am God, and I wouldn't ask myself that question. And David was just appalled. I mean, he had never in his entire life had anybody tell them that they were God. And I said, well, David, you remember when I told you that a lot of the people here believe they're God? Well, I didn't think you were serious. But unfortunately, some of these people are. Well, we actually had a lady come by the booth. This was actually a couple of years later when we were doing a similar one. And she came by, and she'd just come out of this conference in which they were telling everybody they were God. And so she came by our booth, and she said, did you know I'm God? And I said, no, I didn't know that. I was trying to be honest. And she said, that's right, I'm God. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. And so she started telling about herself. And then, you know, a lot of these people are very open, you know, and she started telling us things about herself that I never expected her to tell. I mean, she started talking about some of the problems she was having. She started talking about some of the difficulties. She started talking about some of the things that people had done to her that were bad, how people had mistreated her, some of her physical problems and medical problems. And, I mean, she went on for 10 or 15 minutes. You know, there for a moment I thought that I had finally discovered where they got all the ideas for these soapbox offers on TV, where everything goes wrong, because this lady's life was a mess. And finally, after she had told us a little bit about herself, I asked, well, if you're God, why are all these bad things happening to you? And she thought about it for a moment, put her hands on her hips, and said, you know, that's always bugged me. Well, you know, there's a reason why that bugged her, and it's because the Bible declares that there's one God, and she's not God. And I'm not God, and you're not God. We're made in the image of God. But in creation, God created that which is not God. And, you know, I pointed out to her, isn't it interesting that your experiences in life confirm what the Bible teaches about human existence? That while we're made in the image of God, we're not God. We're finite beings. And as finite beings, we sometimes encounter situations that are beyond our control to do anything about. And as finite beings, sometimes bad things happen to us, and sometimes we can't do anything about it. Isn't it interesting that your experiences confirm the Bible? Now, you see, as Christians, we really have an advantage because I believe that the same God that wrote the Bible is the same God who created reality. And, you know, someone who believes they're God, they have to go throughout life with blinders on. Who was it? Somebody like that? Yeah, Kathy. You know, you have to ignore all the stuff around you that disagrees with the belief that I'm God. And the problem is that even people who believe they're God don't experience reality as if they were God. So this is an advantage for us as Christians when we're trying to reach these people that may have accepted a non-Christian worldview. And getting into classical postmodernism, and I'll be honest, the first time I heard the term postmodernism, I thought it was a joke, because it sounded like an oxymoron. Does everybody know what an oxymoron is? That's kind of like jumbo shrimp, military intelligence. Well, actually, military intelligence is technically not an oxymoron, but postmodern is a classical example of an oxymoron. I mean, how do you become, what's after, you know, modern? Well, one of the beliefs of postmodernism is that there's no such thing as truth. Absolute truth does not exist. A common saying of somebody who's accepted postmodernism is, well, that may be true for you, but that's not true for me. How many of you have ever heard somebody say something like that? Okay. And basically what they're saying is that truth is relative. There's no absolute standard of truth in reality. That truth is whatever you want it to be. You know, truth becomes a matter of personal choice rather than an objective reality that exists in and of itself apart from you. And a year ago almost to this week, I was giving a conference, actually a retreat, for the Baptist Student Union at West Point at the Military Academy. I had not been called sir so many times in my entire life before or since. You know, I wish they'd invite me back. That was a nice feeling. But while I was giving the conference, one of the cadets asked the question, how do you witness to somebody who says there's no such thing as truth? And I said, well, that's easy. Ask them, when you tell me there's no such thing as truth, is that a true statement or not? You know, and he got, you know, it can't be that easy. Well, it really is. Actually, right before lunch, I was talking with Francis Beckwith, who's written a book. Actually, I've got it right here. It's entitled Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. You know, they've actually got a, you know, someone with their feet planted in midair. And it's entitled Relativism. And you know, this is an excellent book for dealing with some of the philosophical arguments of relativism. And I was talking with Beckwith right before lunch, you know, and he was saying, you know, it really is that simple. A person who says that there is no such thing as truth has actually affirmed a truth statement. They have actually affirmed a statement that they are claiming is absolutely true. It was as if they had said there absolutely is no absolute truth, or it is absolutely true that there is no absolute truth. Now, the problem that someone who says that, and sometimes people say that and they don't really mean understand that that's what they've said, is that it contradicts itself. It's, you know, it's a self-contradictory statement. It would be like saying a square circle or a triangle with four sides. It's a statement that contradicts itself. And any statement that contradicts itself is a nonsense statement. And so, you know, someone who's saying there is no such thing as truth is essentially saying a nonsense statement, because either there's no such thing as truth, in which case, how can that statement be true? Because, you know, is that really a true statement if there's no such thing as truth? And if it's not a true statement, then they're not really saying anything at all. Are you thoroughly confused now? But essentially, postmodernism contradicts itself, because on the one hand, they want to get rid of logic and rationality, and on the other hand, they want to use logic and rationality to prove that logic and rationality do not exist. And I think it's incumbent upon us as Christians to point out to people when they're doing things like that, when they're actually being inconsistent. You know, it's not a consistent position to use truth to claim that there is no truth, or to use logic to claim that there is no logic. If there's no logic, then why are they using logic? If there is no truth, then why are they affirming a true statement? You know, it's kind of like, you know, the whole thing about tolerance. I remember I was giving a conference one time, and someone came up to me, and it was I was talking about a cult group, and, you know, the person said, you know, you really need to stop being so critical, Bill. And it wasn't Scientology, it was talking about another group. You need to stop being critical. You need to, start trying to see what you can learn from this group. What's true in this group? You know, what is it that this group is teaching that you can grow from? And I said, there's nothing I can grow from in this group. There's nothing that I can see in this thing that's worth anything at all. And he said, well, you're just being intolerant. And I said, well, it sounds to me like you're being intolerant of my intolerance. And he said, that's right. And he didn't catch it. One of the presidential candidates in South Carolina, and I will not mention the guilty party, said recently And I quote, there's too much intolerance of intolerance in the world. There's too much tolerance of intolerance in the world is what he said. You know, but think about that for a moment. If intolerance is wrong, then how can it be wrong to tolerate intolerance? You know, and that's the kind of problems they end up in. You know, another aspect of postmodernism is the belief that no religion can make exclusive truth claims. All religions are equally true. This is how I'm able to get into the New Age meetings and set up literally a Christian booth and give out Bibles and Jesus videotapes and tracts and things like that, is that, you know, they claim that all religions are true. And we've been doing this for 10 years. Now, I was at one of these meetings in Atlanta, and we were giving out stuff. And 2 weeks later, we went to another one in Tampa, Florida. And a lady that had seen us up in Atlanta and had received some of our literature got upset when she saw us in Tampa. I mean, she got real upset. And so she came down to where we were, and actually it was one of the few times that my boss at that time, not Phil, but somebody before Phil, was there. And she walked up to my boss and she said, "Who's in charge here?" And my boss pointed towards me because he could tell she was upset. And so she walked up to me and she gave me a piece of her mind. Now, I learned from that experience that if you have a large vocabulary, you do not have to use profanity to express yourself. This woman had a very large vocabulary. I mean, she did not use any profanity, but she communicated her thoughts to me very effectively. She said, "I am appalled at what you are doing here. How can you live with yourself? You ought to be ashamed. How can you wake up in the morning and do things like this? How can you live with yourself?" I mean, for 15 minutes, she went on like that. And then after she caught her breath, I said, "It's unfortunate that you think that what we're doing is wrong." Now, when I said that, it was like I had taken a 2x4 and hit her upside the head. Because she literally went like that. "So, oh, I never said it was wrong." Now, wait a second. You may not have used the word wrong, but you have communicated to me very effectively. And you have let me under you have communicated to me in no uncertain terms that you think that what we're doing is not right, that it's wrong. I mean, you said that we ought to be appalled at what we're doing. You know, you told me, how can I wake up and live with myself after doing something like this? How else can I interpret what you've said for the last 15 minutes than you really believe that what I'm doing is wrong? "Well, I never said it was wrong." Well, granted, you didn't say the word W-R-O-N-G, but you used several synonyms, and you communicated the thought to me very effectively, I might add. You know, she literally turned around, walked away, had her head down, and is literally talking to herself as she walked away. "I never said it was wrong. I never used the word wrong. I did not say it was wrong." Now, apparently in her mind, she thought that it was okay to criticize someone and to communicate to them that what they were doing was wrong as long as she didn't use the magic word wrong. Now, personally, that's playing verbal semantics. You know, and you see, her problem was that she believed that you could not tell anybody they were wrong. But she felt like that what we were doing was wrong because it was contradictory to what she believed. And so instinctively, she felt like we must be wrong because we were telling people things different than what she was telling people. We were teaching something that contradicted what she believed. And she was in a quandary. On the one hand, she wanted to tell us, she wanted to, basically, what she did, give me a piece of her mind. And on the other hand, she wanted to still affirm that all religions are true and there's no such, you can't tell anybody they're wrong. Now, the problem with the philosophical position that all religions are true and that you can't tell anybody they're wrong is that if that happens, then you can't critique anybody. You can't criticize anybody. You can't even get to the point where you can give someone constructive criticism so they can improve themselves. If no one is wrong, how can they improve themselves? You know, that's the problem that you end up there. You know, and Actually, Beckwith in his book gives the example of being at the doctor's office, and he's talking to the doctor's assistant, the nurse, and they got into a conversation. He says, you know, I'm getting ready to write a book, and I'm just trying to find out what different people believe about this subject. Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? And she said, okay. And he said, do you ever believe it's right to tell someone, is it ever okay to tell somebody they're wrong? And she thought about it. She says, no, people ought to be able to make up their own morality. And he said, well, what if someone was torturing an innocent baby for fun? Would that be wrong? And she thought about it for a moment. And she said, now, I personally would never do something like that. But I do think that people ought to have the right to make up their own morality. So you would say that it's never okay to tell somebody that torturing innocent babies is wrong? Well, I think people ought to be able to make up their own mind. Now, Beckwith pointed out that, you know, if her next door neighbor was actually torturing a baby and she knew about it, she probably would call the police, like any person would. But see, the problem is she's accepted this postmodern belief that it's never okay to tell anybody they're wrong. And people accept that belief, but they never really get around to thinking about some of the implications of it. I mean, if that belief is true, then how could we say that what Hitler did is wrong? As a matter of fact, in his book, Conversations with God, Book 2, I'm trying to think of the author's name right now, but the title was Conversations with God, Book 2. The author of that book had one chapter in which he said, Hitler didn't do anything wrong. And he goes on to say, Hitler didn't do anything wrong because there is no such thing as right or wrong. So if there's no such thing as right or wrong, then we can't even say that what the Nazis did in the Holocaust was wrong. If there's no such thing as right or wrong, we can't even say that what Corrie Ten Boom did in trying to hide Jews from the Nazis so they could avoid the concentration camp, we can't even say that was right. Now, the problem for the person who says that there is no such thing as right or wrong is it's almost impossible for them to live in this reality, to live in this world, and to effectively, or I should say consistently, act as if they really believe that's true. It's just like that New Age lady. You know, when she saw us there, her instincts took over, and in her heart, even though she may not have used the word wrong, she felt that what we were doing was wrong. And that we were there telling people they were sinners. Don't you know it's wrong to tell somebody they're a sinner? Or as Yoga Journal in 1988 in a full-page editorial said, it is wrong to tell someone, it is a sin to call someone a sinner. Think about that for a moment. It's a sin to call someone a sinner. It's wrong to tell somebody they're wrong. These are statements that are self-contradictory. We as Christians must affirm the teachings of Jesus Christ. In John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, that is a very exclusive claim to truth. Jesus did not say, I am a truth. He says, I am the truth. Now, when we as Christians say that Jesus is the truth, that's not self-contradictory. We're at least claiming that there is a truth. Now, we may be wrong, but at least that's not self-contradictory. Now, I believe we're right, but at least in and of itself, it's not a statement that is self-contradictory. But when someone says that all religions are true, I mean, that's a nonsense statement. Basically, what they mean is all religions are true except for the religion that says that all religions are not true. As Dr. Phil Roberts pointed out in his speech yesterday in the plenary session, my denomination was recently criticized because we were going to send people to Chicago to try to share the gospel of Jesus Christ in the city of Chicago. And we were accused of such things as hate crimes and encouraging hate crimes, and even Joe Lockhart, the presidential press secretary, got involved and said some negative things about us. But there's nothing inconsistent with the Christian position here. You know, if it's wrong to tell anybody they're wrong, then that means that it's even, we can't even say that the Heaven's Gate group was wrong when they committed suicide so that they could catch a ride on a UFO that was, you know, trailing the comet. As a matter of fact, a lot of the news reports that I saw, I mean, you had people that were unwilling to say that what they did was wrong, especially a lot of the relatives, you know, like, well, they made their decision, you know, it was their choice. Well, granted, they had the right to make their choice, but, you know, the fact that somebody has the right to make a choice doesn't mean that they can't make the wrong choice. Okay, I'm trying to see how we're doing on time. I want to cover one other thing. Another belief that is prevalent in America today is the belief in reincarnation. Now, technically, this is not necessarily postmodern, but it just shows how there's many competing belief systems in America today. Now, closely associated with the classical understanding of reincarnation is what's known as the law of karma. This is especially coming out of Hinduism. Now, karma basically teaches that what we experience in this life is a result of what we did in a previous life. And, you know, I ran into a guy at a New Age meeting one time, and he, you know, said that, well, I grew up Christian, but I became a New Ager because Christians don't believe in reincarnation and New Agers do, and reincarnation to me just explains why things happen to people. And I said, well, that's interesting because the reason, one of the reasons why I could never become a New Ager, and one of the reasons why I am a Christian, is because I cannot accept the belief in reincarnation as being true. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, for one of the reasons that I couldn't, one of the reasons I could not accept reincarnation is that reincarnation teaches the law of karma, at least in its classical sense. And one of the beliefs of reincarnation is that whatever happens to a person is a result of what they did in a previous life. And he said, that's right, that's what I believe. And I said, well, one of the implications of that is that there is no such thing as an innocent sufferer, at least the classical understanding of reincarnation. And he got to thinking about it. He says, well, I never thought about that before. One of the associates that I work with is Dr. Ravi. And Dr. Ravi grew up in India as a Hindu. Things were going great for Dr. Ravi. He was the son of the mayor of the town. He was born into one of the highest castes in Hinduism. He was wealthy even by American standards. Even by American standards, he came from a wealthy family. Things were going great until in the mid-50s, at about the age of 3 1/2, he contracted the polio virus and got polio. Eventually he got to where he could not walk, you know, was paralyzed, and none of the doctors could do anything. And finally, as good Hindus, his parents came to the conclusion that Ravi must have done something terribly wrong in a previous life, that he had a curse upon him, that his karma was cursed, that the reason why he could not walk was that he was a bad person. Now, can you imagine a young child with polio being told that the reason why he had polio and could not walk was because he was an evil person? But that was one of the logical conclusions of the belief in karma for the Hindu family that he grew up in. When somebody would come over to visit, they would ask little Ravi to leave the room so that he would not offend them by his presence. Now, most Americans have a hard time with that implication of karma. Even New Agers have a hard time with that implication of karma. You know, we're not willing to say there's no such thing as an innocent sufferer. For example, if a woman is brutally raped, most Americans, even those that believe in reincarnation, would not want to say, well, she deserved to be raped. It was her karma to be raped because she must have been a rapist in a previous life. Or JonBenet Ramsey. Most Americans would not want to say, well, JonBenet Ramsey deserved to be murdered in her home because she must have been a murderer in a previous life. That just doesn't fly with most Americans. The idea that there's no such thing as an innocent sufferer is morally bankrupt, I believe. But that is one of the implications of the classical understanding of reincarnation and karma, especially as that which comes out of Hinduism. Now, I would like to say that Dr. Ravi eventually ran away from home and became a Christian and actually got his doctorate in theology, went back to India, and witnessed to both his parents, and both his parents and most of his family are now Christians. One of the approaches that he used was, you know, Mom and Dad, when I was growing up, you told me that the reason why I had polio was because I was an evil person. And I'm here to tell you that the reason why I had polio was not because I was an evil person, but because God knew that the polio that I had, He could use to bring me to faith in Him. And if it had not been for the polio that He allowed to come into my life, I would have never known Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. And I want to share with you the same hope that I have. And his parents accepted Christ and became Christians. Even though his father had built a Hindu temple at one time and totally financed it. Well, I could keep going on. Any questions? Yes. Name me one culture that says it's okay to kill an innocent person.
I'm trying to think of, like, let's say we go back to child sacrifice. So in cultures that dealt with child sacrifice, so that's
right.
Acceptable.
Okay.
Now, how do you transfer that to say that that was what they did was right versus, and then we over here on America.
You mean what they did was wrong?
Yeah, okay. How do we now bridge the gap between the two?
Well, I would point out that even in that culture, like the Canaanite culture, there's a difference between saying that we disagree on what's right or wrong and saying that they did not believe anything is right or wrong. Even in the Canaanite culture, for example, where they would practice child sacrifice, which the Bible sometimes refers to as passing the child before the fire, you know, and we've actually dug up idols, you know, with, you know, the potbelly stove, and you know, so the flame would come up and the hands like that, and they would put the baby, and yeah, they'd be burned alive. Even the Canaanites believed there were some things that were right and some things that were wrong. The problem is that we don't agree on the same things. Now, I would argue that because of the fall and because of sin, the conscience of humanity has been corrupted. And people will sometimes call call what's right wrong and what's wrong right. But that doesn't mean that everything is relative. And I think most people would point out it's a very unique culture that would do something like that. But even in that situation, I think you might even want to argue that when the parents would do something like that, they saw that as not punishing the child, but as the opportunity of the child to do something on behalf of the community. They did not see it as a bad thing. Now, we would see it as a bad thing. I would argue that the consequences of the fall and the corruption of the human consciousness is one of the reasons why things like that can happen. Well, I think we can use biblical reasoning. Once we point out that you can't function without there being a right or wrong, then that gives us an opportunity to say, for example, if somebody says there's no such thing as right or wrong, everything's relative. You know, you cannot say that what the Canaanites did in sacrificing children was wrong. Well, you point out, well, is that a true statement that it's wrong to tell, you know, to say that it's wrong what the Canaanites did is wrong? You know, and then you point out how they're using an absolute true statement to basically say that everything is relative and how that's contradictory. And then once you get them to realize that, you've basically knocked their feet out from under them. And then you can say, let me share with you the reasons why I do believe that what they said was wrong. Actually, this brings up one of the arguments for the existence of God, which is the argument for morality. Apart from the existence of a personal supreme God, there can be no absolute morality. I personally believe this is one of the strongest arguments for the existence of God. Now, the argument does not depend upon everybody agreeing on what's right or wrong. Simply the fact that everybody has an intuitive understanding that some things are right and some things are wrong, even though that understanding may have been corrupted by the fall, and in some cases, you know, even the sacrificing of young children may be understood as, you know, being okay. Still, even the Canaanites believed some things were right and some things were wrong. You know, for example, they would have believed it was wrong to have desecrated, you know, one of the one of the temples of the gods, for example. Intuitive sense that some things are right and some things are wrong come from. Well, there's really no adequate explanation for that sense of an absolute morality apart from the existence of an absolute God. Yeah, I mean, because society can't provide an adequate foundation. Because, you know, if you want to argue that society provides an adequate foundation, then, you know, does that mean that it was okay to kill Jews in Nazi Germany, or that it was okay to practice apartheid in South Africa, or it was okay to practice slavery in a society when slavery was practiced? You know, so there are problems with saying that society determines morality. The other, you know, option is that, well, the person determines morality. But as Beckwith points out in his book, if a person determines their own morality, then what's the difference between that and having no morality at all? For example, somebody that has no morality at all, what do? They do whatever they feel like doing. Okay, what about the person who determines their own morality? What do? They do whatever they feel like doing. So what's the difference? If there's no difference between a person who has no morality and a person who determines their own morality, then logically they're the same. Does that help any? Yeah, well, C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity is pointing a lot of this out. Yeah, I had forgotten he had talked about that. But it's not unique to him. He just did a good job of explaining it. Yeah, there was another, yeah. Well, I think it's a cop-out, and someone has already mentioned this this week. You know, you've got all these choices. You know, you've got all these different religions. You've got all these conflicting moral standards. How do you know which one's right? Most people, in the face of all these choices, basically just cop out and say, it's too much to decide, I'm just not even going to worry about it. And so I would say that postmodernism is essentially a cop-out. You know, it's intellectual laziness.
That's the word I was going to use. It appears to me that the Ten Commandments are the greatest cultural underpinnings of a society can have to have a free and just society. Mm-hmm. But I wish God, sometimes, as arrogant as it may sound, I wish God had added one more commandment.
Well, you could see it implied. I guess it would. You could argue it's implied in the other ten, but yeah, yes. Yeah. I would. Yeah. Well, I have a basic philosophy of, in witnessing to postmoderns or anyone, basically anyone that has accepted a non-Christian worldview, which I like to call weed pulling and seed planting. You know, Jesus tells the parable of the different soils. And how some of the soils, you know, you've already got weeds there, and the weeds choke out the seed, and it doesn't bear any fruit. Well, now, if you're a farmer, and you've got soil that's full of weeds, you just give up? No, you plow the field. You get rid of the weeds. And so, basically, my strategy is we try to deal with some of the theological or philosophical weeds that may be in that person's life, such as the fact there's no such thing as absolute truth. are the fact that I'm God. And, you know, try to deal with some of those weeds. And, you know, a lot of times these people don't believe in the Bible. You know, as far as they're concerned, the Bible is just another book written by people. It has no authority over them whatsoever. And so if you just quote a Bible verse to them, it's like water off a duck's back. They might quote the Hindu scriptures back to you or something like that. And so, arguments of pointing out some of the, you know, facts that, well, what you've given me is a self-contradictory statement. It's nonsensical. It's simply trying to pull that theological or philosophical weed that is keeping the gospel from taking root in their life. Now, once you've dealt with that weed, you know, and you want to do it with gentleness because, you know, you don't want to, you want to have the ground prepared for a seed to be planted. Then, once that weed's been dealt with, then use the Bible, then use the Scripture, then share the plan of salvation, then share the gospel with the person. Well, Beckwith's book does a pretty good job on postmodernism, you read it through a couple of times, and it's amazing how if you've read something before, then whenever it comes up again, it's natural. You know, you don't have to think about it. You just, you know, well, is that really true that there's no truth? I mean, it just kind of comes out. The first time you encounter some of these things and you don't really know where the person is coming from and you've never thought through a response before, it can be very difficult just coming up with it on your own. And so I think the reading can be very helpful from that aspect. And I would encourage you to read his book.
That was really not available.
No, he's actually going to be moderating the conference. It's going to be right after this. But I don't know if his book's in the bookstore or not. But I'm sure you could order it. Oh, it is available? Okay.
I believe I've seen it.
Yeah.
I think it's in this book.
Okay, yes. Okay.
I might have commented on something you just said, though, like people not believing in the authority of the Scriptures. How do you answer people who are either Catholic saints or Protestant, and there are within their own ranks, you know, the Catholic Church makes some comments about Scriptures, or Newsweek every year comes out with something that seems to repudiate the authority of the Scriptures, and so it sounds like, well, even Christians aren't buying into the whole thing. Any
comments on that? Well, that is a problem. You have whole sections of, you know, Christianity, or at least a lot of the mainline denominations have almost committed theological suicide by that process, in my opinion. But that's not true of all Christians. And, the denominations that are still growing haven't done that. If you want to see the results of that on a society or a Christian society, go to Europe. And in England, less than 5% of the people attend church on a given Sunday. In Europe, it's even worse. Or I should say in Germany or other places like that, it's even worse. Whereas I went to Romania a few years ago, and you know they were suffering under communism for a long time, and I was riding to a little village church to preach, and my translator was there, and I saw all these people that were getting on the streetcar. I mean, the streetcar was jammed on Sunday morning. Now, when I am driving down the highway to church, you know, where I live, and I see somebody jogging down the highway, sometimes I'll joke to my wife, and I say, well, I guess they're running to church. And we just kind of laugh, you know, and you know, realize that that's not really what they're doing. But the translator turned to me and said, oh, yes, that's what they're doing. They're all going to church. I went to the evening night service, and they had 2,000 people in the one church that I was in Aradia, and that was just one of the churches that was there, and they only had 100,000 people in the whole town. So, communism tried to, you know, kill Christianity and totally failed. Christianity was much stronger after communism than it was before communism. But, theological liberalism that denies the truthfulness of the Scriptures will destroy a church, in my opinion. Exactly. But you know, I would just simply say, well, you know, let me just share what I believe. You know, let me share with you why I believe the Scriptures, and just give it as a personal testimony. And then let the Holy Spirit witness to the person's heart. Okay, over here.
I live in Boulder, so I encounter New Age people and all that stuff all the time. But the people that I do struggle with is atheists that, like the universal negative, just
yeah.
work on that. Our philosophy majors aren't, you know, concerned about all that stuff. They just are for sure that there's no God. And I have a very hard time speaking with those people.
So they're not concerned about being self-contradictory?
Yeah, I just don't know if I could get the universal negative across to them.
Well, read up on it. Roman Catholic theologian Hans Küng has got a whole section on it in his book on Does God Exist? He's got a whole section on there. It goes into great detail, and he's Roman Catholic. Yeah.
That makes a suggestion on that, isn't it? You know, I learned how to argue by arguing with a friend, and this is over politics.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have that classic education anymore. Where we learn stuff.
Yeah, and that brings up another point I just thought of. Ask questions. You know, don't make statements, but ask. Try to get the person to think. And it's the best way is by asking questions, and do it with gentleness. And the worst thing you can do is to come off, you know, of superior attitude, you know, or something like that. You want to, you know, share the hope that we have in us with love and with gentleness. And role-playing can be very, very important and can be very helpful. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that there Christian theologians have come up with answers to some of these things, and we ought to avail ourselves of them. You know, and these are, you know, for example, the universal negative, I've used that with great success. I mean, this is not something I've just read about. I've actually used it. Now, the problem is some people, especially a lot of atheists, have not really studied philosophy, and so they don't understand the significance of that statement. The person that it had the greatest impact on was the philosophy major at LSU that I used it on. I mean, she instantly understood the significance of it before I even explained it to her. But, you know, just me sharing it right now is not enough for you to get it down well enough that you're going to be able to use it in a conversation. But at least you could, you know, go somewhere else and maybe read a little bit more on it. And this is not original with me. It's not even original of Hans Küng. This is something that Christian theologians have observed for many, many years. And many of them have done that. Okay, there was another question?
Yeah.
But you don't want to go too far on that, yeah.
Absolutely, totally.
Yeah.
Devoid of any knowledge of the scripture whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It's even hard to point out their own cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Before you begin to educate them
in
what you
describe. It's like the guy that I ran into that had the PhD in genetic engineering. He was no dummy.
But he ignorant.
Totally ignorant of the philosophical arguments for atheism. I mean, I knew more about why the philosophical arguments for atheism than he didn't know any of them. Well, I wasn't going to explain to him what those arguments were if he didn't know about them already. But, I mean, he just didn't think philosophically. And a lot of people have that problem. But, you know, just because some people are not used to thinking that way, it doesn't mean that it's not valid. You see, because I do believe we as Christians have an advantage. Logic is on our side. I really believe that.
Can I add to that when Paul went to Greece, he had to deal with Epicureans. Well, he knew about Epicureans. But you have to know more about what they know than they know and argue their position to your position. And that means that's a big task. That's why intellectual laziness means like a horrible sin, because we're in our religion, much less theirs.
Now, you can't argue a person into the kingdom of God.
No,
I don't want to. I hope I haven't given you that false assumption.
No, that's not what I'm transferring either. But at the same time, intellectual laziness, if you cannot talk to a person from a common position, you can't communicate with them at all.
But you may be able to deal with some of these theological or philosophical weeds that may be preventing a person from accepting the gospel by using some of these classical Christian apologetic arguments. Oh, yeah.
Argue in depth with someone else. But if you have a few key points that you can stand on, that can prove, if you understand basic elements about what those things believe, then you understand how they establish righteousness or how they deal with truth or sin and those things. And that's often when you get foothold in and then argue for that and argument.
Okay, this will be the last one. I think we're out of time. Right.
They're not, you know, even if they say, well, I refuse to believe that. Well, okay, then go ahead and drink poison. What's going to happen?
Right.
Okay, just because you don't think anything's going to happen, there's consequences for anything you do. And so you need to bring them back into a spot where they need to consider that the choices that they make are relevant to their lifestyle.
Yeah, I didn't talk on this, but in our society, they've confused religious tolerance with an acceptance of postmodernism that there's no such thing as absolute truth. Everything is relative. I believe Scientology is wrong, but I believe Scientologists have religious freedom and should have religious freedom. Now, I think that's true tolerance, because how can you tolerate something that you don't disagree with? What is there to tolerate? True tolerance is when we disagree with someone and we still give them the freedom. Now, the fact that we give them we believe that God has given them the freedom to make their own choices in this area doesn't mean that we don't believe they can make the wrong choice or that any choice they make is necessarily right.
The definition of tolerance has changed over 20 years.
Yeah.
20 years ago, it used to mean I can reject what you say or the behavior you engage in, but I can defend your individual rights. Nowadays, I have to tolerate everything you say and everything you do.
And if I say,
can't criticize you.
Yeah.
That's their way of shutting you up when they want to do what they want to do. And don't be shut up. You know.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Huh? Oh, have you read it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Eric Kmet got Beckwith to send me a copy.
Oh, okay.
But that's been a fantastic tool. I found many people who really